Today's episode of Dog Nation Daily is brought to you by Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Presented by DogNation.com, this is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. Here's your host, Brandon Adams.
All right, there's a lot we do know, still plenty we don't know about the Georgia schedule this upcoming season. I won't get into a lot of the facts about the delayed SEC championship game, the delayed start to the season, the two off weeks built into the schedule. Those are all important things, although you can just read about that directly at DogNation.com. I want to spend most of our time reacting to some of the news that's out there, including the one piece of information that we do know a lot about at the moment, which is that Georgia, for the first time, you had to go back to like 1924, for the first time in a very long time, will not be playing Georgia Tech here in 2020. It's a really disappointing thing for a lot of Georgia fans. Some Georgia fans don't care so much about that. Admittedly, I'm not as wrapped up in this tradition as I am in many of the other traditions around the Georgia program. As I said before, different people feel differently. This is not that big one for me necessarily, but I do want to talk about how we got there. And the narrative that's going to be kind of spun here is, well, the SEC schools, Georgia in this case, when it comes to Georgia Tech, they're the ones that shoulder the blame for this. They could have behaved differently. They could have done something different. And these in-state rivalry games, including clean old-fashioned hate between Georgia and Georgia Tech, that could have been preserved. And I think when you go back and look through, this is going to be pretty in-depth here for a moment, but when you go back and look at the timeline of how we got here, you sort of realize that maybe this was just kind of always the way this was destined to be, even if at the onset of these discussions, the intention was to do something different. If we go back to the beginning of this month, near the beginning of this month, when the SEC athletic directors met in person, a long scheduled meeting for the first time, it just so happened that meeting took place shortly after the Big Ten had announced that it was going conference only for the 2020 season. The SEC athletic directors meeting had been scheduled for a long time prior to that. And we got some leaks coming out of that meeting almost as soon as it was over. Ross Dellinger from Sports Illustrated had some good reporting on this. There were a small handful of scheduling models that were considered, according to Ross Dellinger. One of those models that was thought to be a possibility was maintaining the 8-game conference schedule and only playing one non-conference opponent. And frankly, on the basis of Dellinger's reporting and just a kind of a healthy dose of common sense, going back to early July, that's kind of what I thought the SEC would probably do. They would lob off the kind of bye games, the groups of five and the FCS level opponents. They'd keep the same 8 SEC games. And since almost every SEC team, with the exception of Texas A&M and Alabama, had a Power 5 non-conference opponent, and schools like Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and Kentucky had long-standing in-state rivals, they'd find a way to play those games plus the 8 conference games, and that is what they would do and kind of call it a day. However, at some point in time, we know, we have strong reason to believe, that line of thought changed, because there was some very clear reporting from Dellinger, Sports Illustrated, about the meeting of the SEC athletic directors going back to early July, that at the time, it was considered, and the word that was used here directly by Dellinger was laughable, that people within the SEC, presumably athletic directors, were saying it was laughable that the SEC would play more than 8 conference games because, presumably, how tough it is to play extra SEC opponents, and I would also add maybe how tough it is to schedule and keep everybody happy adding those additional conference games. So, like, the one thing that we pretty clearly knew going back to July, the beginning of the month, from Dellinger's reporting in Sports Illustrated, was the SEC consensus was, of all the models we're considering, the one that no one really wants to do, at least for the most part, based on what Dellinger reported at Sports Illustrated, nobody wants to add more conference games than the 8 the SEC is slated to play. However, as I said, at some point in time, that consensus, that process, started to change. Pat Forty wrote at Sports Illustrated this week that the SEC had actually already decided that it likely wanted to move on to a 10-game conference schedule prior to the ACC's announcement that it was playing 10 conference games with Notre Dame as a playing member of the conference, with the option open for one non-conference game as long as it was played in the home state of the ACC team. What Forty reported at Sports Illustrated was, is that the SEC had actually already decided it was going to play 10 conference-only games, and the ACC's announcement was an attempt to get out in front of what the SEC was doing. And as Forty wrote, and we talked about this on the show yesterday, all of this was seemingly a way of saying that the non-conference rivalries did not get played. It'd be the SEC that took the blame for this as opposed to the ACC. Now, I'll put that part of this aside. I won't speak about that one way or another, at least for right now. I'm just trying to get the timeline established. It certainly seems like what 40 reported at Sports Illustrated could have been true on the basis of something we heard from Greg McGarrity yesterday. McGarrity essentially confirmed he was asked, hey, were you surprised at the university presidents of the SEC decided to play 10 conference-only games? McGarrity said he was not surprised because that's what the athletic directors already wanted to do, seemingly confirming the Pat 40 report. Let me let you hear McGarrity with reporters from yesterday.
That was a recommendation that was made to the presidents after our call yesterday. So, no, I was not surprised in the decision. And, you know, we had so many variations of models to look at that we had to narrow them down to two or three, which we did. But in the final analysis, keeping everything within the SEC was from a medical standpoint for the whole. I mean, there are four of us that have in-state rivalries, but there are 10 others that don't. When you're able to control your schedule from an SEC only, it's more efficient. You don't have to worry about trying to schedule when those games happen and how it's fair to the other schools, and knowing that you have some flexibility on the back end with the SEC championship date.
So listen, I mean, obviously the health part of this is a big thing, but privately we know a lot of these conversations are about more than just health. They're about the health of the leagues themselves, the money that comes in, the money that you prevent from going out. That while health is a major concern here, it's not the only concern. We're all big boys here. We can talk about this. It's not the only concern that these conference, university level, athletic department administrators are dealing with here. So a question becomes, so how did we get from what Ross Dellinger reported beginning of the month that SEC folks did not want to play additional conference games to where we are here at the very end of the month, which is the athletic directors recommended to the presidents that they only play SEC games and they add two more of those games? I think this is a very interesting question. We're forced to speculate on some of this, but on other parts of this, we don't have to speculate very much at all. In fact, let me go back to yesterday here on Dog Nation Daily, presented by Kroger, when longtime veteran college football reporter Tony Barnhart joined us, the guy known as Mr. College Football. I asked him, how do we get from 8 conference games and laughable to play more than that to now 10 conference games being the thing the SEC has to do? And I thought that Tony Barnhart gave a pretty important answer in terms of how this evolution might have occurred. Here's Tony from yesterday.
I think it's about giving your television partners the best possible television inventory. It's sort of a given that you do need to play 10 games. If you're going to challenge for the college football playoff, you don't want to play 8 or 9 games. So I think all those things figured into the mix.
So in other words, what Tony Barnhart is saying there is if you go back to one of the options that was allegedly considered by the athletic directors near the beginning of July, play the 8 conference games, play one non-conference opponent for schools like Georgia, that meant preserving a rivalry with Georgia Tech, and maybe just kind of calling that a day as a 9-game schedule. The truth is, even a big college football fan like me would have kind of been okay with that if it was Georgia's schedule, because all you're really getting rid of is you're essentially trimming fat. It's no Louisiana Monroe. It's no East Tennessee State. You would be losing Georgia Virginia, but frankly, nobody really cares about Georgia Virginia outside of Georgia fans who just want to see the Dawgs play somebody. And given the fact that Georgia was the only SEC team with 2 Power 5 non-conference opponents, that game was kind of already on life support, given the fact that Gary Stokin, the CEO, the guy who runs that game, the Chick-fil-A kickoff game, said they couldn't have the games in Atlanta anyway if there weren't a substantial number of fans in the stands, or at least some fans in the stands. We knew Georgia Virginia was on life support anyway, so I'd kind of resign myself to the idea that if it's 8 conference games plus Georgia Tech, the non-conference rivalry, that's 9 pretty good games, and that's kind of enough for me. However, it sounds like from Tony Barnhart there, not to put words in his mouth, but it sounds like he's saying the TV folks said that wasn't enough football, that you're talking about going from a 12-game schedule to a 9-game schedule. You're essentially reducing your inventory by 25%. That means 25% of the ad revenue that the TV partners have has to be given back. Potentially 25% of the money that TV gives to the athletic departments, the SEC itself, might not be coming to the SEC's way. And they said, we've got to find a way to play more than just 9 games, and adding SEC games may be easier in the long run than finding non-conference games for a lot of our schools that don't quite have those non-conference games built into their schedule. So from that standpoint, it just seems like this is maybe where this is always heading. The other thing you add into this discussion is, if you go back a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Detroit Free Press report, about how the Big Ten schools seemingly felt very confident in their ability to cancel games against, in the Big Ten, it's a lot of MAC schools, maybe it's some FCS-level opponents, but we would call those bye games, the home games in which big schools pay big dollars for lesser opponents to come into their stadium. It sounds like the Big Ten felt very confident in their ability to cancel those games without owing money to the opponents they were supposed to play. There was some question about how confident the SEC felt about that. These are called force majeure clauses, typically, in these contracts, your ability through an act of God or whatever else to say, hey, this contract can be voided, we don't have to pay you the money. One of the things you've seen in a lot of reporting here recently is that the SEC's best out on some of this kind of stuff was some sort of alteration in the league schedule that's made and caused the SEC, allowed the SEC to throw up its hands and say, hey, I'm sorry, we can't play Louisiana Monroe this year. And by the way, on the basis of this contract, we don't owe you any money either. So from that standpoint, there's also the chance that by playing 10 SEC games and just capping at that, saying we're playing nothing else, makes it a little bit easier for these SEC teams to get out of the contracts they have with their bye opponents, which is a large chunk of money going out the door in a year in which you're not expected to have any fans in the stadium or very few fans in the stadium to help offset that cost, because ultimately that's how a lot of these SEC teams make that money back, is through the money they make in the stadium on those days when East Tennessee State, Louisiana Monroe are kind of coming into the ballpark. So from that standpoint, it just sort of seems like this is where this was always heading. Now, I do understand the emotion involved in a cancellation of a game like Georgia Tech, clean old-fashioned hate, as I told y'all on the show yesterday. There's a lot of backstory for Georgia Tech in this rivalry. It is one of the storied ones for the Dogs. UGA, of course, has many. Yesterday, Greg McGarrity did talk more about the emotion involved of having the Dogs and the Jackets not playing this year. This is what McGarrity said about that.
That game means so much to everyone. It's just unfortunate that it was affected, but you know, there's so much change going on in today's world that we just need to expect the unexpected. And I think it just happened that it just was not able to be worked out, and it's unfortunate, but you know, we look forward to resuming that rivalry in 2021, and we'll just go from there.
I mean, listen, the overall bottom line for me is this, is that I do feel a little less passionate about this than many of you do. I would invite you to check out yesterday's edition of Cover 4 Live, presented by Georgia Farm Bureau, where our buddy Connor Riley, and it's kind of weird that we typically think of Georgia Tech being an older person's thing. Connor's the youngest person on our staff, and yet, of all the folks here at Dog Nation, he's really the only one that feels strongly that Georgia Tech should remain and continue to be played every single year. I'm just kind of ambivalent about the whole deal. But for those of you that do believe Dogs and Jackets is really important, you should check out Connor yesterday. I'm sure Connor will have some stuff on the site about that here this weekend. He's very, very passionate about that. He's your guy if this is something you still feel very strongly about. I'm respectful to the people who also feel that way, even if my emotion doesn't quite match yours. I guess what I'm saying is, when you look at the logistical consideration, the fact that Georgia does not want to pay big dollars to groups of five and FCS opponents that it doesn't want to play, the fact that there are a lot of SEC teams who don't have a built-in non-conference matchup. TV wanted Georgia apparently to play, and the rest of the SEC to apparently play at least 10 games. All of this leads to a scenario in which this was always where this was going to end up, but the SEC just playing itself and just playing 10 games. And frankly, the ACC's maneuver, as described by Pat Forty at Sports Illustrated, to sneak ahead of the SEC announcement to sort of establish some level of blame game to say, see, it's their fault that these in-state rivalries won't be played, it just comes across as childish. And the media, who obsesses over that kind of stuff, are, you know, worried about process stories in a time when the rest of us are trying to get football on the field. So there'll be some hand-wringing over this. There'll be some whining. Ultimately, Georgia Tech take a year off. 52-7 will live on for another 12 months. And I'm guessing these two teams get back together again in 2021. My name is Brandon Adams, and this is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. We're presented today by Kroger, and glad to have you with us. No matter how you get to us today, live on video, 10 a.m., Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. Twitter's always a little finicky, but we are happy to be back on Twitter again here today. Also, radio at noon on App and Sports Radio 960 The Rev, and as a podcast, wherever you find them, including the world-famous DogNation.com, Apple, Google, Spotify, everything else. Just really appreciate you being a part of the program. By the way, we appreciate our friends at Kroger for making it all possible. And Kroger is the place that you think about and go to when it comes to getting back to school. It's hard to believe that school is starting back up again. But when it comes to that, whether you're going back online or you're going back in person, Kroger continues to be your one-stop shop for everything you need from a school supply standpoint. That's notebooks, pack packs, crayons, markers. Also, getting ready for some good lunchtime treats. Whether you're eating that at home, on your kitchen counter, or at school, in your classroom, probably this year. Probably not going to cafeterias very much, even if you're in school. Either way, Kroger's got you covered for lunch, so check that out when you stop by and visit your local Kroger. We're going to get Jeff Sintel here coming up in just a moment. We'll go on the road with Jeff Sintel, presented by our friends at AAA. We'll do that here coming up in just a moment. I'm also running a little late here today, but there's a lot to cover. So let me do this before we get there. So we know that Georgia will not be playing Georgia Tech. We know that Georgia will be adding two SEC opponents. And the one thing that I think we're also pretty sure of as well, on the basis of everything that's been said, is that the initial thought that the SEC would just be adding the next two rotational opponents for the what would supposed to be scheduled for 2021-2022, which meant that Georgia would have added Arkansas, Mississippi State. Florida, as we talked about yesterday, would be set to add Alabama and Texas A&M, two very difficult opponents. Apparently, that's not going to be the case, or at least there's a strong feeling that that won't be the case, that the schedules might be balanced to make sure that, in Florida's case, they don't get handed two very difficult games. So maybe the credit I gave to Florida for not whining about this yesterday, maybe giving them credit for that was a little bit premature. Either way, McGarrity did talk about what is true and is not true, but the SEC schedule for Georgia for 2020. Let me let you hear more from the UGA athletic director.
We'll play two of the five other Western opponents, and we don't know who they are right now. But the remaining eight games, opponents will stay intact. Dates, maybe not.
So listen, I obviously won't even spend a bunch of time speculating on who's Georgia's new opponents might be. I honestly have no idea. Maybe some of y'all do have reasonable speculation on that. Maybe by the time you hear this show, for those of you that listen to the podcast, maybe you already know. I don't even know when the SEC's announcement's going to come on this. I will spend a minute saying this, though, that when you think about a 2020 year that's pretty clearly a one-off, very different than any other year, the idea that games may be played on different dates, I think, is just as interesting as anything else. For instance, a lot of you know that one of the hills in which I have died on over the course of the last couple of years is the notion that Georgia-Auburn was being moved from November to October. I have just absolutely made a huge deal about that, maybe even a bigger deal than I should have. I wasn't happy with that schedule change as someone who gives opinions for a living. What if after all of this, the game actually isn't played in October? I think that'd be kind of funny. I think Georgia-Florida not being on Halloween could potentially be pretty interesting. First of all, my family would love that if that was true. I've got young kids. They love Halloween. I was saying to our buddy Connor Riley before the show started, just given how much importance there is in Georgia-Florida, is there an argument to be made for maybe moving that game earlier in the season as a way of making sure you get it played? I'll also say this, and we'll bring on Jeff Sintel. You know, there's a lot of this in the SEC, this thing of, and Georgia-Florida is the perfect example of this. These two rivals can't even agree on the amount of times they've played each other. These two teams hate each other so much, they can't even agree on the number of times they've played. That's typically because, like, way back in, like, 1897, there was a game played in a cow pasture, and somebody says it counts, somebody says it doesn't. Or in the World War II era, one team was fielding a bunch of 35-year-olds. The other team was seemingly trying to have, you know, regular college kids. I never thought I would live through a time in which there might be a disputed game between two big rivals. But let's say that Georgia-Florida did play earlier in the year, and obviously Georgia would win. And then let's say the rest of the season didn't take place. Shudder the thought, but at least a possibility worth considering. I could absolutely see Florida not trying to count that game on the all-time series record. Now, around here, the official Gator Hater updater would continue to roll forward, and we would absolutely count that victory. But I never thought I'd be living in a time in which I'd be a part of a rivalry series in which the two teams dispute whether the game counts. But if Georgia-Florida play early in the year, Georgia wins, the rest of the season unfortunately gets canceled, you better believe those lousy, stinking Gators have tried to weasel out of that L. Around here, we will not let them do that. All right, we are busy, as you can tell. It's Dog Nation Daily presented by Kroger. I do want to shift our gears here and get to recruiting, because really, on our comment sections, you see as many questions still about recruiting as anything else, so important to take care of all that right now. So let's go on the road with Jeff Sintel, brought to you by AAA.
Rapids and across the SEC or wherever the recruiting trail may lead, here's a DogNation.com insider.
We will say hello to Jeff Sintel here, who was great yesterday on our Cover 4 Live broadcast, sharing his thoughts on all the ways in which the 10-game conference-only schedule impacts UGA, the absence of Georgia Tech. I'll invite folks to check that out on the Dog Nation video channels to really get a lot of Jeff's thoughts on that topic and really see the interactions that we all had together. I mentioned Connor before, Mike Griffith, myself. Of course, Mike's got some big stuff coming up over the course of the next couple of days there as well. Jeff, let me welcome you, though, in here now on the road, presented by AAA. And my understanding is you've been on the road over the course of the last 24 hours. You've got some big stuff coming up pretty soon on the website from a five-star prospect, so hoping you'll give us a little bit of a preview of that.
Yeah. Hey, guys, good morning. And, I mean, it was a fun time on the road. I was kidding with all the colleagues here this morning that I think I encountered one muffler, two dead armadillos, one broken-down coupe, Miami Hurricane-style that were broken down on the side of the road, but still probably seem very happy about that James Williams thing. I mean, it was one of those things where, if you guys have noticed the pages of DogNation.com, I've been out to, let's see, Cedartown lately. I've been out to undisclosed location number one, undisclosed location number two. Was at Bleckley County yesterday. Spent a good time with a five-star offensive tackle, Amarius Mims. And there's a lot of stuff to kind of unbox with Mims and everything else. But, you know, let me just say very thankfully, it is great. I'm going to say that again, great. I mean, like, you know, Frosted Flakes, Tony the Tiger, great to be back on the road covering these young men, actually getting back into the business of football, seeing things. And now I guess the intro to this men's discussion, man, is Brandon. He has radically changed his body. I think he's every bit of 6'8", maybe even some change beyond that, creeping up towards 6'9". He even told me the pediatricians and the doctors that everybody rely on when we hear these things called growth plates and whether they're open or not. Mount Mims is what I'm going to start calling him. To me. He's thinking he might be 6'10", 6'10 and a half by the time he stops growing. And good Lord, Brandon, I don't know too many 6'10 and up offensive tackles in the SEC or the NFL anywhere.
It puts him in like Bernard Williams territory, does it? I mean, at 6'10", if that's what he ends up being, I mean, assuming he goes to Georgia, obviously, but that'd make him the tallest player in program history. Is that right?
Man, and especially when it's a legit, you know, like, I mean, let's be honest. Like, whenever I hear, you know, one thing I always talk to when I talk to young players and they ask for advice on recruiting is I say, man, be who you are, own what you are. If you're 6'4¾", say that. Don't let your first interaction with a college coach be a disappointment because you said you're 6'5 or almost 6'6". Own what you are. But when you look at Amarius, man, I mean, he's that. It just stuns you when you're used to seeing players for a living. And I know maybe he doesn't have the, you know, Redwood Oaks for teammates along the line with him in Bleckley County. But every time you see him in a huddle, Brandon, and this might be kind of even true when he makes the SEC, is where all the other helmets stop in the huddle, that's the apex of all these helmets.
Yeah.
That's where Marius Mims' face mask starts and it keeps going up. When you can see it a million times, and it'll still get you every time about how big this young man is.
Yeah, so you mentioned, a dramatic change to his body. There's also been some online chatter about a slight alteration to his timeline there a little bit as well. And I don't want you to give the story away in terms of what you've got coming up at DogNation.com on the subject of Mims. But, you know, this is a five-star player that I think a lot of Georgia fans continue to feel confident about ending up at UGA at a time in which some of the other five-star targets of the program have either slipped away or appear like likely that they could slip away. I guess just give me a sense of that relationship that remains between Mims and Georgia here, and how has it maintained as much strength as it has, just given how much success that Georgia has had recruiting the offensive line position going back to the class of 2020.
Yeah, it's you know, the few things that come to mind to answer that question in a lot of bursts is, number one, Matt Luke has been relentless here. Relentless here recruiting Amarius Mims. He now has a final five, and it would be one of those five: Tennessee, Auburn, Alabama, Georgia, Florida State. Florida State's the one that kind of put my mind there for a second, but he had Oklahoma in the top six. He realizes it's going to be very hard to get out to see Oklahoma. And I think, I guess I won't name the retailer per show parameters, but Brennan, to me, this is kind of a rollback for a recruiting decision for Amarius Mims. He thought he was feeling pretty sporty enough, and he had, you know, touted that he was going to make his decision in August. He realized he's not ready to make that decision, so he rolls it back to that previously established birth date in October. And about that, he tells me October will be his drop dead go date. He will make that decision in October. But, you know, in true 2021 fashion, this will make Brandon want to reach for something to help with heartburn. I'm going to avoid that brand name as well. But he just feels like even when he makes that decision in October, that he's going to wait. He's still going to take his visit should visits happen. But as we said on our Cover Four discussion yesterday, man, I don't know. I wouldn't bet a pack of saltine crackers right now. There I go. I wouldn't bet a pair of crackers right now, a pack of crackers right now, that there will be recruits visiting in September, and maybe not even October. So likely it seems, and, you know, Amarius even kind of acknowledged the fact that he's seen enough of these schools, he's seen enough visits, and he'll be able to make that decision in October on all things there. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the things with Amarius that, you know, he's returning back to his original kind of commitment date. And it's funny, Brandon, I would imagine he has been receiving pitches and calls. Good Lord, he's been receiving calls. But as much as anybody, especially during the global pandemic, but he still seems to be a very happy, exuberant, smiling, definitely one of those pleaser kids. And I got to watch him practice yesterday as well, and down there in Cochrane in Blakely County, and that's a unit that was getting after it pretty good yesterday morning in the rain or what else came out of the clouds yesterday as well.
Well, that's great to hear. We're on the road with Jeff Sintel. It's brought to you by AAA. We've got more questions for Jeff coming up. Let me first of all say how much fun it is to have AAA as part of our broadcast here today. You know, I've been a AAA member for a long time. It's gotten me and my family out of a jam many times when I think about my wife being on the road by herself sometimes, flat tire, things like that. If you're the husband, whatever else, there's a huge peace of mind factor that goes along with knowing that someone's going to show up, take good care of her, you know, get her back on the road, get her back home the way she needs to be. And, you know, frankly, just the convenience factor of no matter what kind of automobile issue you might be dealing with. AAA has just been famous for that for a long time. And I put them to use myself many, many times. Also, for every single one of you, they got a great offer right now. How about saving big on your auto insurance? When you switch, you can save with AAA as much as $529. Let me give you a website to go to. It's AAA.com/auto insurance. That's AAA.com/auto insurance. And you can save big with our friends at AAA there. And it's good to have Jeff Sintel on the road presented by AAA here today. You know, Jeff, one of the things we've talked about on our show this week is some very interesting videos dropped by UGA. Roquan Smith talking about Georgia's linebacker university and the satisfaction he has with having chosen UGA as a school. Natress Patrick, who made his way into the LA Rams roster a year ago, saying some similar things. These two videos and the tone that they established didn't seem coincidental. It certainly seemed to me a not so veiled message to a guy like Smile Mondon, who's a very contested recruitment at the moment that Georgia's a part of. Maybe Xavien Sory, maybe Prince Colley there as well. Is this an example of Georgia having to do some things that are just a little bit different because of the absence of visits, because coaches themselves can't be right now like you are on the road presented by AAA, that you have to kind of pull out stops in a different way, and kind of cryptic messages from former players on video that are meant for current recruits, that this is just kind of how you have to do business right now?
Yeah, I think it's just Georgia has resources and they want to allocate those resources into positions of need as much as possible. And for me, I think the way Georgia finishes out it's this class. I know everybody's worried about this thing coming together. I mean, trust me, this staff, if there were zombies walking the earth in a preseason exhibition apocalypse or whatever, this staff would still find a way to get a top five class and get the players that they want and the players that they need. I just think that that's just how well that recruiting staff is assembled in Athens. And I think, you know, Brendan, I almost think it's like recruiting cycle right now, especially for the fan base, and everybody's plugged in and they're starving for information. They want some breadcrumbs or croutons of information about what's happening when really nothing is happening. But, you know, the inside linebacker position, the defensive line position, to me, throw in two cornerbacks or two DBs, and I think that's the major heavy lifting left for Georgia. You remember last year they signed 17 guys on the offensive side of the ball. This is where the axis of the program now tilts back to the defense in terms of the pipeline of incoming talent. And we've talked about this on the forum, Brandon, and, you know, the last thing I'd want to do is disparage the skill set of any of these players, because first of all, if you're being recruited by Georgia, the way this program has recruited recently, let's go number one in 2018, number two in 2019, and number one in 2020. They're recruiting for guys that they feel can start for 2 or 3 years in the SEC. So all these are bona fide, the bluest of blue chip players. But I don't know if it certainly feels this way to me, Brandon, that I think the Mondon recruiting decision is more like a measure of whether Georgia still got it. I know he's rated as a top five recruit. He plays almost every stinking down for Paulding County, dripping sweat all over the field. But I don't know if, you know, you don't look at his film and do you say to yourself, is this the number one or number two linebacker in the country? And then you start thinking, well, how much better is he than a Rian Davis or a Tresman Marshall or a Quay Walker or a Channing Tindall? Is he in that league there with like a Noah Sewell? Is he in that league there with a Barrett Carter or a N'Kobe Dean? You know, that's very highly debatable, especially because you see a guy that's basically on the field the whole time running jet sweep, playing linebacker, you know, just closing ground down in space. He is a superior athlete. He might be as good as any athlete Georgia's recruited for the linebacker position. I think Xavien Sory is another guy that, you know, the athleticism just drips off the film when you watch these guys. But to me, to condense my point, man, I just think a lot of this is, it's not so much of Shmael Mondon and his skill set that Georgia has to have as much as it is a measure of if Georgia doesn't get Mondon and he lets him get away, then maybe the recruiting acumen of the Georgia staff might be slipping a little bit, where I'm going to double down on, I think these unique circumstances are kind of what's causing a lot of this. I'll give you a good example about Mims. This is fresh in my mind right now. Mims was basically saying yesterday, man, he really wanted to check out LSU. He really wanted to give LSU a visit. And he readily acknowledged that LSU probably with a visit might have snuck into that top five. But he realizes there's no way he can do that. The timelines don't match up. He can't do the courting, so to speak, with LSU. So that's a school that, you know, because of this pandemic and because of kind of the governors that are placed on a lot of these kids right now, that's a school that could have been in deep consideration for Amarius Mims, but that's not happening right now with the no-visit mandate from the NCAA. And that's why, you know, we I think we've written a couple times or spoken about it a lot, that I know everybody looks at guys drifting away or the chatter with Auburn, with a guy like Shmael Mondon, and they think that, you know, something's up with Georgia or something's up with the way these guys have been recruiting and are not recruiting this year. I just don't think that at all. That is it at all. I think it is just this unique set of circumstances that are affecting our country.
I want to come back to that topic in a moment. Let me mention one specific name before we get there. While I was on vacation, the five-star, I used to call him a safety. I guess he's a little bit different profile now as a player. James Williams chose Miami. Funny, it seemed like Miami had been coming on strong, given the fact they were part of his final two when they weren't originally part of his final three. Before we get to if anything or what is wrong with the 2021 recruiting cycle for Georgia, in your own words, what happened with James Williams?
Well, I think Williams, there's a momentum thing happening there, Brandon, and it's probably a little bit to do with Ed Reed being the Jonas Jennings now for that program. I mean, one of the true goats of college football and pro football was Ed Reed, and he's now in a personnel option or director of football operations, a kind of a management administrative position where he can touch a lot of players. with the Hurricanes, and man, how can you not listen to Ed Reed? There's a sense of representing where you come from and playing amongst guys from the same neighborhood. There's a little bit of, you know, Corona staying close to family. There's a little bit of, I'm sure, Black Lives Matter in that, in terms of just wanting to go somewhere. And, you know, we play with a bunch of guys that in basically restore Miami to what it used to be. I think those are a lot of currents there that are looking, that just James Williams just decided, you know what, I'm going to represent the area I come from, the people that have supported me, the people that are around me, the people that I know best. And he feels he's a player, and I'd probably definitely agree with him, that he can go and make it do what he wants to do in his college, wherever he needs to go. And perhaps he doesn't need to choose the place that would be the biggest trampoline or the biggest launch point to get him to the National Football League. I think he's thinking more with his decision there about helping Miami, helping Duval County, Broward County, that sort of area, get back to where it used to be, rather than what's the best place to get me to the NFL, the best place to prepare me for the NFL. And, you know, when you invoke the name of your dearly departed mother when you make a commitment, that's one of those that, man, you certainly feel sorry for that story and, you know, the life that James Williams has had to live to get to this point. But you certainly understand where those emotions are all coming from.
So we'll finish on this topic of what actually is going on with the 2021 class. You said earlier that you believe that Georgia will still likely have a top five class. I believe that's probably true there as well, except more than one thing can be true at once. I don't think there's any way right now it can be said that the 2021 class is playing out the way that Kirby Smart envisioned. In other words, all these guys committing elsewhere, or in some cases seemingly trending elsewhere, I have a hard time imagining this is a part of Kirby Smart's master plan on all this kind of stuff. And while we've seen Alabama, for instance, have kind of a down year in recruiting going back 2018, it's one thing to have a down year when you are working from a surplus. But what Georgia is doing is working to get caught up with the very best, most talented program in the country, which for now is still Alabama. That top five might be good enough to keep pace, or it might not. That when you are a Georgia who hasn't yet won a national championship, who's trying to build the kind of talent base that makes that possible, you've got less margin for error than the teams that have been there. And so from that standpoint, I'm not so much concerned that Georgia won't have a class that looks really, really good on paper, but I wonder how well this class is going to keep pace with what Georgia's ultimately trying to do, which is unseat the program that's above it in the SEC, the couple of programs that are above it nationally, and actually get over the hump and win a national championship. I do wonder how much this class is helping Georgia keep pace with that right now. And this is coronavirus aside, because obviously the virus is a big part of this discussion.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so with Alabama, I think, and you know, Terrence Ferguson's certainly a loss. I think that was a guy that Georgia still wanted to have in their program, and there was regret when he decided to go play for Alabama. I got to remind folks about the basic parameters of recruiting. You know why Alabama's recruiting like juggernauts across the offensive line this year? It's because last year they signed a number 300, a number 400, and a number 400 level, 2-3 stars and 1-4 star prospect across the offensive line. When you combine Alabama, those huge trophy cases and those immaculate facilities, and then you basically apply an economics lesson in terms of supply and demand. They didn't get the big boys, the All-Americans, last year. Certainly that means Alabama would be in a strong position to bring in those guys this year, because this is a year they're prioritizing the offensive line.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second, though? If that's true, and I believe that you're right about that, then doesn't that put the onus even more on Georgia with the linebacker spot this year, because they only signed one player, MJ Sherman, a very good player, but only one linebacker a year ago? In other words, if Alabama's doing well along the offensive line right now because it didn't sign big-time players a year ago, then wouldn't that make a potential loss of Smile Mondon, Barrett Carter, who's not coming to Georgia, wouldn't that make those losses sting even more, given how few elite linebackers Georgia signed last season? By choice, of course, but it's still the same scenario, is it not?
Yeah, but, you know, I guess this is one of those pump the brakes messages I'll try to share here. You know, Brandon, when Georgia's got late July a year ago and they brought in Kendall Milton and then they brought in Chad Lindenberg back-to-back, well, that wasn't a top three, top four, top five class at the time when those guys come in. I think it's Georgia having a plan that they applied greatly last year in terms of What do we need? What do we have? We don't have to wait. We don't have to fill up our basket so much with recruits in the spring and the summer, because this is the University of Georgia now. We can pick out and recruit who we want. We don't need to pressure kids into commitment. Georgia always favored the spring evaluation, the summer evaluation, and watching how well guys ran in camp to determine, okay, these are our five linebackers. How do we pick out the two we want? I think Georgia has maybe got hit in the mouth with all the coronavirus and the way that they, and the limitation of visits, both going to campus and then going to the high schools as well. I think they've gotten hit in the mouth a little bit about the new preferred way of doing things intersecting with the ability not to, to very much pinpoint and specialize in the players that they want. Everybody's noticing the Alabama surge and like why Georgia across the offensive line don't have those guys yet. And I was pointing to a specific parameter of, you know, Alabama is targeting bunches of offensive lines. For me, Brandon, this will go down as one of the more amazing stories in this Georgia recruiting cycle. If Georgia can still get a Marius Mims to sign, bring in a Dylan Fairchild, also bring in a Micah Morris, considering they signed four All-American offensive linemen a year ago. And then some other really good depth pieces that were better than anybody Alabama signed, in my opinion, in the 2020 class. I think what we're looking for me to come up on this point, which is, when is it time to start worrying if it's not time to start worrying now? And I think there are three big names left for Georgia in the 2021 cycle. That's Amarius Mims, that's Tyrium Ingram Dawkins, and then that's also Shmile Munden Jr. Georgia doesn't get those three guys, Brandon. I know you'll be panicking unless Georgia doesn't go 3-for-3 there. I know a lot of people that tune into this program every day, they care so much about the success of this football program that they'll start really wondering and rattling sabers about what's going on there. But I think Mims, Munden, and Dawkins are three huge names that will determine whether Georgia ends up top two, top three, top four, or maybe it's a top five, top six, top seven class this year. Restoration of visits, I think, will be big in terms of that happening. But also, sooner or later, these young men are going to have to decide what they want to do with the lack of visits.
Jeff, really good stuff. I know you've got some great things planned on the site this week at DogNation.com. You mentioned your visit with Amarius Mims a little earlier in our broadcast. Can't wait to read more of what Mims had to say and where things stand with his recruitment. We appreciate you being here on the road, presented by AAA. I'll invite folks to check out AAA.com/auto insurance. That's AAA.com/auto insurance. You can switch and save big. Great offer right now. And Jeff will look forward to talking some more recruiting with you next Friday at the same time on the road, presented by AAA.
All right, guys, have yourself a great weekend and watch Dog Nation. We'll have a lot of stories this weekend.
Let's take a look around the rest of the league. This is SEC Through.
So I think everything that Jeff is saying about recruiting there is true and right. However, one of the things I've always had a little bit of an issue with, and this is not an issue with Jeff, it's just an issue with the way that recruiting gets talked about in general. There's a way to spin everything in recruiting so it's never bad news. And you see this with, by the way, coaches. Think about, like, lesser coaches on National Signing Day. I don't care where these guys are ranked. We got the 25 guys that we wanted. Everybody always signs the 25 guys they wanted. Everybody always picked the players that were right for their scheme, right for their program. There's a way to always declare victory in recruiting, and yet those of us who've been around the block a couple times know that there are certain players that contribute to success more so than others do. So when it comes to what, you know, Georgia's doing right now, like, you know, to use the word panicked, I'm not, as speaking as a fan here, I'm not panicked about it. I think there's a really good chance that Georgia still has a really good class. However, if you take the snapshot of where we are at this moment in July, I just think it's obvious, it may even be painfully obvious, but it's obvious that certain things are not quite going the way that I'm assuming that that maybe some of the Georgia coaches expected they probably would. Still plenty of time to react to that, still plenty of time to respond to all of that. I have, and I know Connor Riley's written about this, and I have said on the show that I think you can make a case that because Georgia's not selling early playing time and Georgia doesn't quite yet have the prestige of national championships to sell, it maybe needs visits, it needs coaches on the road more so than maybe a lot of other programs do, that in a weird way you may can say that coronavirus has hurt Georgia's recruiting more so than it's hurt other programs. That's maybe all fine and well, and I could see Georgia making up a lot of ground quickly once those visits are established. But the idea that for a program that hasn't yet won a national championship, that it would be okay if they somehow didn't keep pace this year in recruiting with the national elite, those that it's chasing that have won national championships, I just think that's untrue. I mean, listen, the narrative that we've pushed the last year or so is that Kirby Smart and Georgia had overtaken Alabama as a recruiting power. Now, you know, I'm not going to completely run away from that opinion as of yet, but over the course of the last 7 to 10 days, you can arguably say Alabama had one of its best runs in recruiting ever. The brothers from Texas, the big defensive lineman, Ferguson, you can make case that they were recruiting a stretch, especially along the lines of scrimmage, as any week as well as they've had in a long time. So maybe premature to say that the demise of Alabama recruiting was upon us here. And, you know, that's why I say there's no asterisks on this season. You can't say, oh, 2020 is a weird year, or the 2021 recruiting cycle is a weird year. None of this counts. No, it all counts, because the players that Georgia does get, it gets to use in future years. The players that choose to go elsewhere will be playing against Georgia in future years. So definitely don't panic with the 2021 class. But let's also not pretend that this is all negligible in terms of how all this is playing out. No, these recruiting battles that are being waged right now, even if they are being waged on a very strange battlefield, they still matter and they still count. Let's move on to our SEC through here just for a moment. There was an interesting report from Josh Kendall from The Athletic, quoting a member of the South Carolina Board of Trustees, saying that the only vote among the university presidents against the 10-game conference-only schedule came from the University of South Carolina's president. That it was 13-1, according to the Board of Trustees member who spoke to Kendall, who covers the Gamecocks, 13-1 in favor of a 10-game conference schedule. So if this is true, this obviously means that UGA voted against the idea of continuing to play Georgia Tech for 2020. They voted for the 10-game conference schedule, according to what a source told Josh Kendall from The Athletic. It's kind of easy to understand why, if there was only going to be one abstention on this, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I believe that Greg McGarrity has told us before that the SEC, generally speaking, likes to move with a pretty strong consensus on stuff. They like to have something close to unanimity on, you know, the directions that they kind of move in. So it's not a surprise that, you know, like, it seems hard to imagine that this thing would be like 9-6 or something like that. No, I'm terrible at math. Good Lord. I can't even come up with something that equals 14. But you know what I'm saying? Like, the idea this was going to be a close vote, it was probably not all that likely. So even, you know, it seems like they want to try to build a consensus. Maybe not a surprise that South Carolina was the one that went the other way, because you can make a case that South Carolina is very different than Georgia, who has Florida and Auburn and these rivalries that have a lot of history and tradition. You can arguably make a case that the second most important game that South Carolina plays is the one it plays with Georgia. Georgia does, I mean, nowhere near view South Carolina in that same kind of prestige. So the South Carolina-Clemson game may be more important to the Gamecocks than the Seminoles are to Florida, or the Yellow Jackets are to Georgia. I guess Louisville, Kentucky may be a little bit more like that. But according to a report there, it was only the Gamecocks president who went against the idea of the 10-game conference-only schedule. A couple other things to get to here for a moment. So, well, think about how all of this impacts the rest of the SEC. And I guess the consensus thought right now is the initial reports of, hey, it'll be Alabama playing Florida, it'll be Georgia playing Mississippi State and Arkansas, that maybe some of that may have ended up being jumping the gun just a little bit. If you follow Major League Baseball, I don't know, Nightingale said this the other day. He said that had the coronavirus breakout that happened for the Marlins, if it happened for the Yankees, the high-powered, most high-profile team in Major League Baseball, that maybe Major League Baseball would have shut down the entirety of the sport. But when it's just a team like the Marlins that for the most part has very few fans, no one really cares about, very few, you know, noticeable players, it's easy to just kind of partition them off in the corner and keep on playing the rest of the sport. I almost wonder if a version of that might be potentially true for the SEC. That when we think about non-conference games, you know, Georgia, Florida, Kentucky, South Carolina all have traditional non-conference rivals. You have teams like Tennessee and LSU that had games in particular that many fans were looking forward to. But the one team that had none of this was Alabama. Now, I don't know that Alabama has the most power of any team in the SEC, but there are plenty of fans who think that they do. There's some high profile, you know, like think about what some of the stuff that James Carville, the political analyst who's a big LSU fan, think about some of the stuff that he has said on ESPN with the power that Alabama wields in the SEC. I don't know if that's necessarily true. In fact, I probably believe it's kind of not. But you do kind of wonder if the SEC deciding not to play any non-conference games would have been different if Alabama either had a high-profile non-conference rival that it always played or a non-conference game currently on its schedule that still could be played. Alabama was slated to play USC. That game was canceled once the Pac-12 decided it was only going to play conference games. And so Alabama was one of the teams that had no Power 5 non-conference opponents to be scheduled. You almost wonder, would there have been more of an appetite for playing non-conference games had Alabama already had one scheduled, just given what some people think about the Crimson Tide? That's at least one of the things that's rattling around in my brain. And then finally, as part of our SEC through, as mentioned before, for all the attention we'll give on this show to Georgia Tech not being played, and for much that'll be said about Florida and Florida State not being played, a rivalry that, if you follow it closely, is a lot more political. I never really thought of Georgia Tech as a particularly political rivalry, but there's a lot of politics involved in Florida, Florida State. I think part of that due to the fact that the Seminoles are in Tallahassee, which is the state capital of the state of Florida. It just always seems like there's been a lot more politics tied into Florida and Florida State. So that'll get a lot of attention for not being played. But really the big loss for many of the fans is going to be the fact that we were going to get LSU Texas this year. That was going to be an incredibly fun game. I think the Texas is a playoff team. At least I think they have a very good chance of being that. Been a great game. Tennessee, Oklahoma. Would have been a great game. I mean, even to a degree, Sam Pittman coaching against Notre Dame would have been a lot of fun. Arkansas was slated to take on the Fighting Irish. So the attention will go to the rivalries that don't get played, but in terms of the actual big games that we lose, it's some of these one-offs, you know, Tigers and Longhorns, Vols and Sooners. It's losing some of that kind of stuff that matters the most. So we'll make that your SEC. And here on Dog Nation Daily, presented by Kroger, let me also give a quick shout out to my friends there at Kroger as well. We talked about, you know, kind of getting back to school, and for some people that means something kind of different this year. We have a lot of teachers that, especially this time of year, they check in on our show because they don't get to watch it live or listen to it live during the regular school year. So they're kind of with us right now because school, for the most part, hasn't started yet. Well, for those of you who are teachers who are with us, or many of you who know teachers, your spouse is a teacher, something like that, Kroger's got something great for teachers during the week. It's Wednesday, so check this out next week. An extra 10% off school supplies, toys, electronic apparel. It's Wednesdays at Kroger. You're already there anyway, getting the household essential items you need and the food that your family eats. Go ahead and save big as well when you are a teacher. You can do that at Kroger. All right, here on Dog Nation Daily, let me also get back to Georgia. We know about the 10-game schedule. It will include Florida, as we said earlier, maybe a new date, at least for 1 year for that game. But the venue in Jacksonville, according to Athletic Director Greg McGarrity with reporters yesterday, that plan is unchanged. And I thought McGarrity gave a great reason as to why. Here's the UGA AD.
I talked to Scott a little bit earlier. The one thing I wouldn't want to do was to play Florida here with a limited crowd and then go to Gainesville in 2021 with 93,000 fans. I don't think we want to be in that position. So, right now, unless something changes, that game would still be in Jacksonville.
So listen, I think that's a really good reason. I'm going to give credit. Somebody heard Mike Griffith and me arguing about this on Wednesday show. He actually tweeted this to me. It was a really great point that it's an inequitable deal for Georgia. Even though the Georgia would be slated to get this year's home game, it'd be inequitable to have an empty stadium home game for Athens and then go play in the swamp next year. That's just not a very fair trade if you're UGA, and smart for Greg McGarrity to kind of point that out. And great job by a Dog Nation Daily listener and viewer for reaching out on Twitter and making that point ahead of what Greg McGarrity did. So I think that's all pretty interesting. By the way, speaking of Mike Griffith, he's got a big, big guest coming up on Monday. The executive director of the College Football Playoff, Bill Hancock, will be with him on his regular On the Beat show on Monday. So make sure you check that out with him on Monday night. By the way, speaking of those lousy, stinking Gators, Georgia going back to Jacksonville this year. 1,371, that's the streak. That's how long it's been since they've beaten Georgia. That number's going to keep climbing. We'll see you Monday, Dog Nation Daily, presented by Kroger.